This is Catherine O'Connell and welcome to Lawyer On Air. If you are looking for inspirational stories about women in law, then this is the podcast for you. Join me and my lawyer ladies as we enjoy a glass of wine after a hard day at work and talk about the world of women in law. It's my passion to share stories of amazing legal ladies who are working as in-house legal counsel, who have law firm roles, who are leading on boards and who are doing law differently. From time to time, I will also invite special guests on the show to share their insights on legal recruiting and tips for getting hired as a successful lawyer in Japan. I hope you will enjoy getting to know these amazing women who I am so proud to share a profession with. I'm glad you're here and I hope you enjoy the show. Hi everyone, welcome to another episode of the Lawyer On Air podcast. In this episode, I share with you another diverse story of a woman working in the law in Japan. I'm Catherine, the host of the show, and I'm a lawyer based in Tokyo for 20 years, and I love helping unlock the wisdom of the stories that women in law never tell. What I've learned from my career so far is it's better to regret for trying than not trying. Those are the words of Naoko Matsuzaki, who is my guest today on the podcast. Naoko is a graduate of law from Keio University and is managing director at KPMG as a core member of the leadership of a new team. She assists clients on mitigating corporate misconduct, namely prevention, detection, and incident response and enhancement of a compliance program for her clients. Her team is currently like an internal startup working on building this new practice within the next few years. You can check out Naoko's full bio in the show notes. But in this episode, Naoko will share with you how working with others in projects and even on the other side of a tough negotiation can actually be a way that you interview to work with these people. That happened not once, but twice for Naoko. And if you take nothing else away from this episode, it is Naoko's reflections on these defining moments in her career that will help you to actually find these in your daily work around the people that you interact with across the table or in a Teams meeting on screen. Naoko also shares the analogy of her passion for horse riding and how partnering with a horse gives valuable insights to the different makeup of people, their changing daily moods and abilities, and how that can be so central to empathy in working with clients and colleagues. And you'll also hear Naoko's advice for everyone, and that's her key point. It's better to regret for trying than not trying. That comes from her time in the US where she studied law on a program from her Japanese company at the time where there was zero precedent for a female to apply to law school from that division in the company she was in. And Naoko will also share her favorite book, a couple of favorite sayings, and if you know Naoko, there may just be something she shares with you that you didn't know that will surprise you, just like it did for me. Let's get into it. Hi, Naoko, and welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's such an honor and pleasure to be here.
Thank you. Same here. It's been a little while since we got together because I think it was back in 2018 when we last saw each other, right?
Yeah.
Well, let's pretend that we are meeting up in person. What sort of situation would we be in? Do you have somewhere that you might like to meet up with me? Maybe it's a favorite wine bar, a restaurant, maybe it's somewhere else. And what would we be choosing off the menu?
So I do not have a particular restaurant in mind, but a perfect setting would be sitting outdoors, perhaps on a rooftop bar, and enjoying a glass of champagne.
Oh, you are singing to my heart. Yes. Do you know that I like champagne the most?
Oh, you do.
Yeah, I do. So there's been quite a few people who've talked about it. And I just, once I hear it, even though it's in the morning, I think, oh, I'd love a champagne. But that would be lovely. When it's out of rainy season, let's do that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Great. Well, as I said, we did have a meeting in 2018. We were both panelists at FEW FEW stands for Four Empowering Women. And since that panel discussion, when you and I spoke to the group, you've done so much. And I'm really super happy to have you here and provide this space that you can tell us your unique story.
Well, thank you for saying that. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, because I believe in particular with you, you've had certain tipping points in your career. And you're someone who's always endeavored to make the very best out of every situation. And I think what your story is going to be really insightful for people who are listening and maybe struggling with certain tipping points that you had, that they could listen to you and find it very helpful. So let's see how our chat unfolds today.
Yeah, looking forward.
So I often ask on the podcast to have people think back when they were a child or in their young adult years, what careers they were dreaming of. And I know when we had a little conversation before this, that in your case, you didn't really have that dream profession, like doctor, or lawyer, astronaut. And so tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah. So as you just described, I really didn't have a dream job. Perhaps I still don't have a dream job, or I don't know what it is. So I wasn't this determined child who was dreaming about becoming an astronaut since 5 years old and actually made that happen. But rather, I was always wondering what might be a good fit for me. So what I was trying to do instead was to make the best effort of whatever that was in front of me or whatever opportunity was provided to me and see what happens. So what I was thinking is that, you know, chances or opportunities are not there forever. So you need to just go for it when it's in front of you. And I think that was what I've tried in my career, and that is what got me here.
That's exactly what I feel. It's that I think you talked about an accumulation of mental attitude when we were talking together over email. And I think that every single little piece that you've done into accumulating that attitude has what's been your real key to keeping on going and getting to where you are now.
Right. Yeah. So I totally acknowledge that each and one piece of such decision-making is very small, but it's just an accumulation. You know, maybe it's like tiny bits and pieces if it's just for one day, but you know, if that accumulates, it could lead to something significant.
Absolutely. There's a saying, isn't there, in Japanese? What is it? Chiri tsumoreba?
Oh, yamato naru. Yes.
Yeah. So even dust, if it accumulates,
right,
and become a mountain.
Yes.
I always love that expression, right? It's the little kotsu, bit by bit, that brings you to where you are. I really believe in that too. So when did studying law come up for you as a study pathway?
So honestly speaking, I was not really into law in college, but rather my interest started when I started working at NSK. I started my career joining the International Trade and Relations Department at NSK. And there, the team was dealing with international trade issues and foreign regulatory investigations. And that was when I encountered international trade law in a real business setting. And that made me interested in law and practical law from a business standpoint.
I see, right. So you did actually study law at Keio University, majoring in political science, but from there you joined this company. It's a company, correct? Or is it a government organization?
Yes, it's a company.
Yes, so you joined this company and you're in the International Trade Relations Group. And before we recorded today, you said to me that place was the super ice age. Can you unpack that for me? What does that mean? Is it the environment that you were in when you first landed that job?
Yes. So it was over 20 years ago when I was job hunting as a college student. And back then, it was called the Employment Super Ice Age in Japanese, Chōhyōgaki. So back then, companies or society in general did not have the idea of like diversity and inclusion. So it was pretty common to be rejected just because you're a female applicant. So in order to be accepted, or even just to get an interview or get brochures sent to you, you had to make additional efforts than my male peers, because you won't even be able to stand on the same starting line. And sometimes I needed to sort of oversell myself, sounding that I am super good at something. For instance, I was selling myself as I am very fluent in English.
That's so good, isn't it? I mean, you are super fluent in English now, but I'm not sure how you were 20 years ago. I certainly,
That,
right? 20 years ago, I was
right.
not fluent in Japanese. So that's what you did, is you oversold yourself in order to just get to the starting line.
Exactly.
Oh my goodness. And so you did that, and then what happened when you got on the company? Because you can oversell yourself, but what happens when you actually turn up and you're in the middle of these trade negotiations? What happened?
Yeah, so I sold myself as a fluent English speaker, but as a new grad, just fresh out of school, I really didn't have much knowledge about like the corporate basics, like how corporations operate, or I didn't have much knowledge on business English as well. So I think it was very different from getting good scores on paper exams versus being able to use practical English on a business setting. So it was super embarrassing when I really couldn't complete a sentence, so to speak. When I was preparing with the US attorneys for the meeting, or when I had to respond to verifications conducted by the Department of Commerce. So I was like, oh my God, like, am I like damaging the reputation of the company? Am I causing damages to the employer kind of thing?
And what happened though? Were you really doing that? Was it as bad as you thought, or do you think it was just bad because you're in the middle of it?
I think I was pretty bad, to be honest.
Wow. I mean, that is a real tipping point, I believe, because you are in this situation where you're probably not sleeping at night, where you're worried about what's going on. Are you doing your job? You're
Yes.
probably concerned that they may say, look, you're not who you said you were.
Exactly.
So what did you do to get through that?
Yeah, so for the first couple of months, I tried to keep up by studying what was in front of me, like the emails and the materials that was given related to my work. But that kind of hit the ceiling. So, I eventually decided to study at SIML Academy, which is a famous simultaneous interpretation professional school in Tokyo. And that was when I think I started English the hardest in my life, because they just throw you with all these like excessive homework, and the classes are so intense and filled with tension. So you're really forced to study. While I was obviously, working as well.
Incredible. Yeah, because I think few of us here know SIML, and I've had their interpreters in meetings live translating, and they are absolutely amazing. So you didn't just dip your toe in the water of an English school around the corner. You went into the deep end of the pool.
Right. So I did go observe like those English conversation schools as well to see like what they teach and what you learn. What I thought back then in my early 20s was that even if you repeat going to English conversation schools, what would be left afterwards? And what really struck me, what SIML struck me, was that you really get like the core ability to understand and the techniques of studying English. So I thought this was real.
Absolutely. And I love how you've said it's, you know, what would you be left with? And with that kind of intensity of English training, you have to absolutely know what every word means, but also the meaning of the sentence to convey the context. So it must have been absolutely right. So useful. I can see how that's helped you now for the work that you do that is so precise.
Right. Yes, you are absolutely correct that you cannot actually interpret or translate if you don't actually understand what is being spoken.
So true, because sometimes you might come to translate something from English to Japanese or Japanese to English, and you realize just how poorly the base language is written in if you can't translate it.
Right, exactly.
Oh my goodness. So what does that part of your career mean to you now when you were 20 years ago, right? When you were in your early 20s, and is there anything you'd do differently now? Would you do that all again? So I'm asking you this question because maybe there's someone else who's going through a similar situation as you did then and thinking, I'm just collapsing in my English ability or another ability. What do I do? What would you say to that person?
I would say, yeah, try SIML or some other simultaneous interpretation training school. But you should do that probably at your early stage of your career, because I do not feel that I can repeat it now when I'm older.
Looking back at yourself in that company now, what would you think about that person there as you're looking from older Naoko back to the younger Naoko in that situation?
I think you made a good decision as a 20-something-year-old.
There you go. Isn't that great?
Yeah, I hope so.
I think so. I think it's really brought you full circle to where you are now, and we'll get there eventually. But you then joined a Japanese corporate, and you found yourself absolutely in the middle of negotiating in English with US counterparts on US law and situations that had you talking about the US jurisdictions and venues for courts. I think that this was also a tough time for you. Can you tell us about the challenges then and how you got through them?
Yes, after spending a couple of years at NSK, I wanted to do something that was more frontward looking. And there was this position at Hitachi where they were looking for someone who would lead contract negotiations with a gigantic US company. So I thought, yeah, that should be interesting. And I decided to apply for that job, and I was successful. But again, I was probably overselling myself a little bit, saying I'm fluent in English, I have basic knowledge of US law, and I can negotiate. But the thing was that I immediately noticed that the Japanese company was in a very disadvantageous position, because first of all, we needed to negotiate in English, which is a foreign language to most people. And the contract itself was governed by US law, and the jurisdiction venue was US court. And I think perhaps the most challenging part was that Japanese people in general are not trained with this US style negotiation skills and techniques. So it was very hard for me to negotiate on equal grounds, although I did enjoy this like dynamics of, you know, like live legal arguments and contract negotiations. So I started wondering like how Japanese companies can be on equal grounds with the US counterparts.
So how can they be? How did you overcome that by helping your company be on equal ground?
Yes. So I eventually decided to target studying at a US law school. If I did, I would probably gain a deeper understanding of the law itself and also be exposed to US style negotiations, which law schools probably teach. But the challenge then was that US law schools and studying abroad was pretty expensive. And I did not burden my parents for that. And then I learned that Hitachi has this corporate sponsoring program where they support foreign studies at foreign graduate schools. So I decided to take the chance. But the challenge again was that people told me that there was no precedent for a female to apply or anyone applying to law school from the division. So it was probably a low chance for me to get accepted. But anyways, I thought, well, it's probably better to regret for trying than regret for not trying. So I decided to take the chance.
And you took the chance, right? You didn't want to regret for not trying. You did. And in
the
face of people saying not to, and who are these people saying not to do it, or that were telling you that there's no precedent? Who are these people telling you this?
My bosses and my colleagues. Yeah, pretty much people around me.
Right. And did they then start to encourage you as you started to apply for these law schools?
Oh, yes, yes. I would presume that they were not making those comments to discourage me, but they probably wanted me to understand the reality. So once I decided to take the chance, they were very, very supportive.
Right. Okay. And at the time when you were also doing those negotiations with the US company, I'm actually curious if any of the lawyers on the other side, on the US company side, did any of them offer any advice or assistance to you even after the negotiation finished? Because you would have been very intensely working with them. I'm just wondering, because sometimes lawyers on the other side, even on rare occasions, do offer up, you know, you've got the ability, but if you did this, you'd be even better. Anything like that happen to you?
It was actually not the attorney on the other side, but it was the senior vice president who was leading the entire negotiation from the US company. She was extremely supportive of my idea, and she actually offered to write me a recommendation letter, which I was very, very grateful.
Wow, that's amazing, isn't it?
Yes, yes.
She's in the company, in the American company on the other side of the negotiation, and she offers to do that for you.
Yes.
Wow. Why do you think she did that?
Yeah, and I did not have the courage to ask from my side, but she actually proactively offered.
That is beautiful. Yes. Why did she do that, do you think?
Well, I think she was pretty much there when we were on the negotiation table. And she was probably observing me and my struggles and my embarrassing moments as well. So maybe she wanted to sort of help me, encourage me, yes, to study in the US.
Right. Did you tell her you were thinking about it? And she said, yes, you've got to do it. Let me help you, kind of thing. Oh, wow. That is so amazing. Just shows you, right, that you never know who is watching and who cares about you to take that extra step and offer some help. That's really amazing. And so you actually do get into a very prestigious law school.
Yes. So I still think I was very lucky, or it was a miracle, or maybe it was a mistake.
Or maybe it was real. Tell us about that.
Back then, again, I was leading the negotiation and I was super busy. But at the same time, my boss, who was the general manager of the department, he pressured me, saying that you can only apply to the top 10 law schools because it's not worth an investment for the company. And on top of that, he also said, you should apply to one of the top 3 schools just to test your competency.
Ooh. Okay, I think this is coming from a place of kindness, but it doesn't sound like it when you say it like that.
Right. Yes.
Okay.
So I was like, serious? I did not even know whether I would be accepted to any law school. I had no idea, frankly speaking. So that really made me sleepless. And so I was flying to the US for contract negotiations, but on the plane, I was like studying for TOEFL and trying to draft my essay. And I was debating over whether I should review the contract draft or whether I should rewrite my essay. And I eventually decided to rewrite my essay on my flight.
I'm laughing because I'm sure many of us are on business trips and yeah, we know we're going to get to the preparation for the actual meeting in good time, but sometimes we utilize our fly time to do other things. And look what you did. You got your essays done and you got accepted. Where did you get accepted?
So it was a miracle. And I was accepted to Stanford.
And how did you react?
I honestly thought I might want to decline because I was so frightened. I was so scared that going to this top school would be too embarrassing if I could just cannot keep up with my classmates, or if I drop off, what if I couldn't earn a degree, especially because the company was sponsoring me and everyone was paying attention as the first female applying to law school. So I seriously did think about declining.
That is so interesting because most people would think of, you know, shouting from the rooftop, letting off streamers, popping balloons, or doing something like that, you know, champagne, as we talked about at the beginning, but you almost right. thought of declining and yes. you were afraid. Yet you applied for this job coming out of KU University, talking up your English ability, and that didn't stop you. You didn't think of failing once you joined the company. So what is still going on there for you that you thought, even after getting an offer letter for Stanford, you would think of turning that down?
All the people around me, including my university professor who was kind enough to write recommendation letters for me, and my bosses, my colleagues, everyone was like, no, you should accept it. Yeah. I was very strongly urged to do so.
Yes.
And the vice president that I was talking about earlier, she was like, you should always go for the best.
Love that, right? You should always go for the best. She's right. I hope she's going to be listening to this after. I hope you share it with her. Absolutely great mentoring from her. And you were able to obviously talk with her quite freely. And that's just a beautiful outcome from the negotiations that you were having with her. So what about this chapter in your life? There you are, you're applying for this law school, you get it. Tell me about what you think now of yourself. Again, looking back, what the strengths you must have had, or how you could help someone else who's thinking about this. They've got the offer letter from a university in the States or UK somewhere, and they're thinking about contemplating studying or perhaps even working overseas, and they're doubting themselves. What would you say to them now?
I would repeat the vice president's advice, always go for the best.
If you go for the best, that's a great piece of advice. If you go for that and it doesn't work, it doesn't work out for you, what do you do then?
Try your best then. You might not always get the results that you expected. And that happens actually all the time in your life. But then you should not just like shut it down completely, but rather maybe take an 80% chance. It might not be 100% for you, but still, if you still have 80% left, then I don't think that's a failure.
Yeah, no one's going to really know about the other 20%, are they? It's all in your mind, and in that's what might stop you, the other 20%. But 80%'s all right, isn't it?
Yeah, that's how I try to believe in these challenges or struggles.
Yeah. So how was Stanford? Tell me. You know, you're sitting and I've been to that school and looked around just to have a little look at it, what it looks like, right? What the grounds look like, what it looks like inside classes. I've been inside there, but I haven't studied there. How was it for you?
I mean, it was totally beyond my imagination. It was so astonishing. It's really hard to describe in words. You really need to experience it. And what was mostly amazing was the people. There are all these talented geniuses from all over the world, but they're so open-minded and they're so humble. And they're always very inclusive, that I did not feel excluded just because of being a female or being a Japanese, but rather I really felt welcomed into the group.
I know when you just made reminded me when I went to the Stanford, I think the office, and asked if I could sit in one of their classes. They would just say, sure, you know,
yeah,
come on, let me take you to the next one. Or what's your interest? We'll take you there now. It was incredible. I hadn't really arranged it before I went, but I got such a good impression of that particular school had I decided to study there. But it was amazing. And I loved the class and the way that they did it. So I have a feeling of what you're talking about, even though I didn't study there. But yeah, that's incredible that you went from almost declining it to it being an incredible journey for you.
Yes, Stanford totally changed my life and my view towards life.
In what way?
It really broadened my horizons. Pre-Stanford, I felt I was probably living in this small pond in Japan, whereas once I was at Stanford, I felt like I saw the Atlantic Ocean and the Pacific Ocean and perhaps the moon as well. It really opened up my eyes.
Oh, that's such a great description. Yeah, and this is the benefit of moving overseas, isn't it? Because I heard through the pandemic, many young students, young people are not considering going overseas now from Japan. And
I know.
I feel that's such a shame. What do you think about that?
Yeah, so I've been hearing that recent students or the younger generation are more protective or turning into introverts, where they do not have interest in studying abroad or they're scared, etc. And I really want them to at least see what it's like. And if you don't like it, that's totally fine. But at least not to shut the doors before even being exposed to it.
Oh, absolutely. I want them all to hear that. That's just incredible. So, wow, you've been at Stanford. It's opened your mind from small pond to the moon. Mm-hmm. What happened next? I think you joined Kirkland and Ellis, and that was in Chicago, right?
Yes. So after somewhat being successful in graduating, I had a chance to work at Kirkland & Ellis in their Chicago office. And that was also a very eye-opening experience for me, seeing the U.S. law firm from the inside.
What kind of things surprised you or made you have this eye-opening experience in the U.S. law firm?
So back then, I was working for a very traditional Japanese company, and that's the only world that I knew. And also, as a client, you only see the output or the deliverable that is provided to you. So I did not really have an idea of how they function internally. And what was mostly surprising was that how efficient they are, that they charge time in 6-minute increments.
That's
whereas,
right.
Yeah. I had no idea.
Yeah, 6 minutes. Because 6 minutes can go by 10 and become an 1 hour, 60 minutes, can't it?
Right. So
that's why we divide it up into 6 minute units.
Yeah. And that was like so surprising to me, because at a Japanese company, it was pretty common to have like a 2 hour or a 3 hour meeting that leads to nowhere. Whereas if you're managing your time in every six minutes, you probably really think about being efficient and being outcome driven. So that was like a drastic culture shock for me.
That's really, really good to know that you thought that, because that gives you real insights as a what you were then, right? You were still really connected with the Japanese company, even though uh-huh. you were working with Kirkland & Ellis, right? You were sort of a guest at that firm. Is that right?
Yes, I was a visiting client.
Visiting client, that's right. So as a visiting client, you're getting these insights of, oh my goodness, we spend so much time in meetings and we're being charged for it. We need to be more efficient in the way that we work with our outside legal counsel and what we do with our uh-huh. own time efficiently, correct? And so you've made me think that, because I come from that background of learning from the get-go about 6 minute time intervals. So mm-hmm. even now, when I'm not doing legal work for clients, I'm doing other work, I think about the 6 minutes.
Right.
As an indicator to myself personally, as the way I do my work or how to be efficient. And I, you know, I might say I've just spent that 10 units on something. What did I do for it? Was I efficient? Have I done that justice, spending that 10 units of 6 minutes? So yes, I still, once you've been a lawyer and you do that, it's very hard to get rid of it. Yeah. So I love that you brought that up, because it would have made you really have some other great insights as well. Were there anything else that came up for you as a US, working in a US law firm?
Also, I noticed that even like first year associates really participate in the discussion. What I mean by that is that at a Japanese company, it is pretty common that there's like 20 people in the room, but it's only like one or two people who actually speak and kind of lead the conversation. And junior people are not really expected to speak or participate, but rather just take notes. So it was a very different setting to see these like first year or second year associates also engage in the discussion and really participate in the decision-making process.
Mm, that's a really good observation. It's so true. That must have meant then that when you returned to Japan, it would have been a bit of a reverse culture shock.
Exactly.
What happened when you came back to the company after that time in the States? How long in total were you in the US for then with your study and at the firm?
So it was a total of 2 years.
2 years. Okay.
1 year of law school, the LLM program, and the other year at Kirkland & Ellis.
Right. So after 2 years of induction in the US, you returned to Japan. How was it when you came back to the company?
It was so difficult, because I was really probably contaminated by the US way of doing things.
Contaminated, okay.
Yes.
Affected, really well affected by that, right? Brainwashed? No, we won't say that. But it's, yeah, you are. You've been smothered in it. So you're covered right. in a US approach. Naturally, you've been immersing yourself in that culture, in the business culture and law culture there. So naturally, you would come back with that. How uh-huh. did that feel then in Japan after that experience?
Yeah, so I don't want to sound rude, but it felt like Japan was still in the medieval times.
Medieval times, okay.
For instance, just to get approval, you need to get the stamp from like 10 senior people. And if one of them were traveling overseas on a business trip, then you had to wait for 1 week or 2 weeks for that person to return. otherwise you won't be able to get the approval through. And I was like, really?
Or somehow find out their calendar before they leave and run to their desk and get their stamp. You are telling me a story I've heard a few times. Yes, waiting for the approval until someone gets back. That is very much what I've experienced as well. What else happened?
Or going back to the meeting setting, for example, at the US law firm, it was common to have like a 30-minute meeting and bang, 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 they make a decision, done, and everyone goes back to work. Whereas in Japan, there's this 2-hour or 3-hour meeting when there's like 20 people in the room and one person is speaking all the time and others are either taking notes or taking a nap. And I was like, what?
Yeah.
What is going on here?
Were you able to implement any changes in the Japanese company at all from your US experience? Any even incremental small changes? Because I know you talk about the little things that add up to make a big difference. Were there any little changes you could do?
I did try to communicate the importance of being efficient, for example, or share my experiences of how it was like to be at a US law firm. And people did listen to me, but at the same time, there's this Japanese style of doing things that has been repeated for the past 100 years. So it was really hard for them to really implement the change, although they probably understood in theory.
Yeah, I think once they live that experience that you had, they can take it all in and understand it. But unless they've had that themselves, it's a little harder.
Right.
Right. But you did stay with the company, and I know you moved up the ranks and you went on to manage the work in a landmark case. And so again, this is another chapter opening for you in your career. I think another pivotal defining moment, because that case also led you to jump to the world of consulting and professional services with PwC, which is where you were when I met you, right? You were at PwC.
Yes, yes.
Mm. So what happened in that timing?
Yes. So after returning back to Japan, I moved to the corporate headquarters legal department. So the corporate headquarters legal department is the highest legal authority of the entire Hitachi group. And I was mostly working on international litigation and defending regulatory investigations by foreign regulators. And among the cases that I was working on, there was this one landmark case that was very new to the company, as well as probably to the entire Japanese companies. So that was a very tough case. We probably worked on it for 5 or 6 years, and we eventually settled. But that was when I was working with this prominent senior partner at PwC in the US office. And because it was such a tough case, we worked very closely for 2-3 years up until we eventually settled. So we really knew each other so well, and the team and each person, that I sort of like saw through what it would be like if I were on the other side, meaning if I were part of the PwC's team. And once we settled the case, I had the chance of speaking with that prominent senior partner, and he kindly suggested welcoming me to his team.
Wow. You're like interviewing for a position with him, basically, by negotiating with him.
Yes. We were like working as a joint team, and if you're working so closely on a challenging case for 2-3 years, you really get to know that person, including their performance and weaknesses and personality. So I think we knew each other so well that we really didn't need an official interview, but rather we needed to kind of go through the process.
Right. That makes sense. So PwC were the advisors on your side, as it were.
Yes.
And you're absolutely right, because you would have been seen in your toughest moments, in the highest stressful moments.
Uh-huh.
And how you reacted, how you went through that. And that's often a question that's asked in interviews, isn't it? Tell me about a time that was very stressful and how you managed it. And yet right. you're just living the experience, and so that person can see how you handled it, whether it was all good or whether it was 80% good and 20% wasn't, but 80% was enough.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Exactly.
So, incredible. So you've basically interviewed for your next role through this arduous landmark case that you were doing, and
without intending initially.
And there you go. But you also saw the insights to a company that you thought, they could be quite interesting to work with. And there you go. You worked with that person. You got into that company and started working in their forensics team.
Yes.
Amazing. Because I know that's when we met, and I was just so impressed that you were doing forensics. It sounds like such an exciting area of work.
Yes, it is. So once I joined the forensics team, my core or major responsibility was to lead white collar crime or corporate misconduct related investigations. And as you can imagine, once a company is hit by such incidents, it turns into an urgent emergency. And I did find it a very rewarding experience to somewhat rescue those companies who were facing these emergencies that sometimes even came up on the newspapers.
Yeah, that would scare a lot of people, but you liked it. What did you like about that, being able to rescue these companies that, yes, appear on the front page of newspapers or on your screen in the daily news?
It's somewhat probably similar to being a firefighter, for example. It's an emergency and the fire is all over the place. And you rush to the scene and you try to extinguish it and rescue people. And that part was what felt rewarding to me, being helpful to someone who is in a tragedy.
That's a really great analogy, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that's really helpful to know. And I think it translates to other areas of our work when we're lawyers and helping people out. But in that particular situation, it is so urgent. It is like, if you don't do something, the fire will spread and everything will be gone.
Mm-hmm.
So your job is to salvage as much as you can of the building and rescue as many people as possible.
Right.
And get a good outcome. And maybe that's, again, another 80% outcome. It may not be 100%.
Sure.
So what did that time in PwC teach you about human relations, the way people treat their way of working, right? They're ending up in this terrible situation. Maybe they've lit the fire or watched someone lighting the fire and didn't speak up. Yeah, using your analogy. What did it teach you then about the way people are in human relations in their workspaces?
So when you investigate into those misconduct, oftentimes they think they're doing it actually to help the company. So they try to provide like a legitimate reason of why they decided to engage in misconduct. And they are also oftentimes struggling as well. But my advice is never, ever engage in misconduct or white collar crime related conduct.
Yeah.
It exactly. never helps anyone.
It's a slippery slope, isn't it?
Exactly.
Yeah. So if we use your analogy, lighting the fire, I don't know what someone might use to say as a legitimate reason, but maybe they thought that the way it was going wasn't any good, and the only way to solve it was to light a fire and get rid of it, right? So maybe someone said that, or someone watching the situation who didn't speak up says, well, you know, I was going to lose my job if I spoke up. So it was better for me to remain quiet. Right. And then so perhaps those people are also struggling, as you said. So it's your insight to the human core is that there are people probably struggling, and sometimes they don't have the right approach to the way that they have.
Yeah.
In a situation like that. Yeah, it's very interesting.
I think the Japanese lifetime employment system also makes it very challenging for people to speak up, because if you raise your voice, it could trigger an investigation and could open up the fact that it was actually done for the past 30 years or 40 years. So you don't want to be that person, right?
Yeah. But imagine the other side of that. You are the person that does that, that stops something that happened so long. So you become rather pleased, I suppose, with yourself. Even you might go through some terrible times, but ultimately you were the one that stopped that activity. So now, jumping ahead, you're at KPMG in Japan, and this is a new team, I think, and you're the core member of the leadership. This is very exciting for you. You recently,
yes, thank you.
Yeah, you recently even featured in the Nikkei Shimbun, the Nikkei newspaper.
And I
sort of see this role that you're doing, and you can tell us some more about it and tell me if I'm wrong, but I feel like rather than being the ambulance at the bottom of the cliff, or the, the firefighter to the extent you were before, I think you're now more front end, helping people prevent the need for an ambulance, prevent how someone can light a fire.
And exactly.
You're teaching clients to mitigate conduct, to mitigate misconduct, I should say, and through the enhanced compliance programs and early detection, you're doing this. You said to me that this is like an internal startup inside KPMG. So I'm wondering if this is actually a dream job for you.
Yeah, it could be.
How did you get asked to create this architecture for this team? Did they have an idea, or did you think of an idea for this? I'm very excited to hear about this part of your work that you're doing now.
Yeah, so the team started last July, and I joined in November. So it's been almost 7 months or so. And as you correctly described, it is like an internal startup where we are trying to build this new practice. And everything is very soft. So based on my experiences, I tried to bring in my ideas, thoughts onto the team. But because everything is so soft, that, yes, we're still in the experimental or trial phase, so to speak. And that is what I actually really enjoy, being very creative and engaging in all these interesting discussions, brainstorming, trying it out, making new connections, etc.
So it sounds to me like it could actually be your dream job, because you've got a soft area where you can just be using all of that experience that you had, the US experience, for example, how to be efficient and all of those more harder skills, right? To be efficient, have shorter meetings, but also have the time to do the creative deep diving into brainstorming.
Right.
How exciting. So what kinds of things are you doing? Because I think for some people, they may be thinking, how do I move to a big company like that? But I can do this kind of internal startup inside a larger organization. How do they find this kind of opportunity?
So in my case, I was contacted by a headhunter. And initially, because I heard that it's the accounting firm of KPMG Japan, I thought, well, that's not exactly my expertise, because I'm not an accountant and my main focus was not accounting fraud. But as I continued the conversation, I noticed that well, maybe I can add value to the team because I'm not an accountant, because I have different experiences and different viewpoints. So for example, if I started working for a gigantic company at a legal department where they had 100 people on the team, I probably will not stand out because I'm similar to all the other 100 people. And that would not add much value because perhaps a younger associate could do better in terms of efficiency. So that was not the kind of place that I was looking for. Whereas if people around me were different, then that would probably make me stand out and add value to the room. So that is how I kind of envisioned how I might be able to contribute. And I think that is what I am doing today.
That's a gem of information you've just given. You know, you could easily have turned that down saying you're not an accountant, fraud expert, blah, blah, right? Mm-hmm. But actually you've turned that round to positive by saying that you can add value because you're not everything they are.
Right.
You're going to fill a gap that they didn't even know that they had or that mm-hmm. they needed filling, and you are doing that. That is fantastic.
Yes. And that really makes me realize how diversity is important, because something that I thought was common sense is actually not to accountants, and probably vice versa.
Ooh, that's deep. Right. So that what they think of common sense maybe is more based in the numbers.
Right.
Right. The numbers tell the story, and they do. But there's also this other stuff that they're not aware of that you can help them with.
Mm-hmm.
And that's also how lawyers can be giving a different perspective. Also how somebody's working on a board on a company, and they can give a different perspective.
Exactly.
So it's not all one size fits all. You're absolutely right. The DEI aspect here is critical.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I totally agree.
So you would encourage then people who might think, oh, I'm not this, to think, absolutely, yeah, I'm not this, and therefore I can do X, Y, Z.
Right. Yes.
Okay. So what's been so far something that you really love or have found really satisfying or rewarding about this particular new role that you've got?
I think it's the fact that I can bring in all of my past experiences on the table, working for industry, working as in-house counsel, studying abroad, working at a U.S. law firm, and working as a member of the forensics team. They all come in together. And what I try to bring to the table sounds very new to other members of the company.
Right, because you're bringing in the differences there, and maybe they've been in similar role or similar mm-hmm. company or situation, and you're bringing a different aspect in. That is absolutely wonderful. So what's your theme then for this second half of 2023? You're in this new role. You've been there 7 months. What's coming up for you as your theme that you want to think about, or your goal for the rest of this year?
Yes. So because we are still a startup, so to speak, we're not, you know, trying to chase revenue or trying to hit certain numbers, but rather for the latter half, perhaps we might want to start drawing up business plans. And also, I would like to reconnect with my professional connections and brainstorm perhaps together on how we might be able to collaborate.
I like together. That idea. Yeah, you're getting back in touch with other professionals and connecting across different industries or roles.
Uh-huh.
That would be interesting.
Yeah, and I actually love networking and meeting new people, because they really open up a new world, so to speak. So yeah, looking forward to it.
So I'd love you to finish this sentence for me. The most important thing I have learned from my career so far is?
Better regret for trying than not trying, because I feel that life is short and you only have one life to live.
So do it.
Yeah.
Okay. Wonderful.
Why not?
Yeah, why not? Exactly. Absolutely. That's what I live by. So I don't want to forget too about the other side of you, which is when I read your bio, I was so delighted to learn that you love horseback riding. And not only that, you're certified by the Japan Equestrian Foundation, the Japan Equestrian Federation as a certified horseback rider.
Yes.
How does the world of being on a horse translate into what you are doing now in your roles, right? Your mental strength, maybe trust, observations, agility. I'm not sure what it is, but I know in your days off, you love to do this. So how does it feed into how you do your work?
So I feel that horseback riding or equestrian is a very profound sport because you're not playing the sport. You're not using a tennis racket. You're not on your skis, but you're working together with the horse, your partner. And in order to be a successful rider, it is very important to build a trusted relationship with your partner. And because a horse is an animal, obviously each and every horse is different. They have their own unique characteristics, their unique performance habits. They're good at something, but not as good with another. And also, even if you are riding the same horse, they're different depending on the day. Sometimes they are in a good mood. Sometimes they're not. Sometimes they're difficult. Sometimes they cannot do something that they were able to do the day before. So it somewhat resonates with team building in my professional career. You know, you work together with all these junior professionals, young staff, and colleagues. And obviously, everyone is different and everyone has their mood depending on the day. So it's sort of, yes, to me, it sort of resonates with team building or team collaboration.
Oh, it's so lovely what you just said. It's so true, isn't it? I'm working in a project at the moment where we envisage people on the other side as they were as a child and try to think about that beautiful essence of them as a child rather than the adult that's been affected in front of you right now. So it sort of feels the same there in that, you know, maybe have people have off days or they have days where they could do something and the next day they can't.
Right.
Maybe they could speak in front of people one day and then the next day they're stumbling on every word. And what you've said is just beautiful. You know, when you see the horses going around the equestrian field, you see sometimes they knock the top rail off, whereas the day before they were, you know, mastering going over four rails.
Yeah.
So it's absolutely true, isn't it? The differences between people each day and the horses that you're dealing with. That's a beautiful synergy there that you're talking about. And of course, horses have the most gorgeous, gorgeous faces and eyes, right? So that must be quite a good de-stressor, I would think, too.
Yes, it's very relaxing and healing, especially, you know, when I was on the forensics team dealing with these white-collar crime and like misconduct, etc. It sometimes gets really intense and stressful. So yeah, just watching the horse, their lovely round eyes really was healing.
Yeah. And beautiful lashes. Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. Yes.
Well, I know you also outside of work and outside of horse racing and horse riding, I should say, you do quite a bit with the Stanford Oval Japan chapter representing Stanford University. And I know it's volunteer based.
Yes.
Helping undergrads admission. So you work at different college fairs and provide consultation to potential students. What is it about this volunteer work that you like? And would you encourage younger people to get into volunteer work?
Yes, because Stanford gave me this totally amazing experience that I really feel that I do wish to give something back to the university. And one way I frame it is by volunteering for Stanford. And that is why I took the leadership role of Stanford Oval. And the other thing that is very rewarding for me is that you really meet these junior high, high school students who are really dreaming and very passionate about their future. So I really want to encourage them to dream big and fly high. As we discussed earlier, you know, there's this trend that the younger generation is hesitant to go overseas, but I really want to encourage them not to close their eyes. I really feel that it is a very rewarding experience, one for giving back to Stanford and two for assisting those young potentials.
Absolutely. And what's one big piece of advice that you give them when you're talking to them?
If they're interested, I do tell them to just take the chance. And if you take the chance, you might like it, you may not, and that's totally fine. But I think it's at least worth trying.
Perfect. Well, Naoko, is there anything else that we didn't cover today that you wanted to mention, or that we did and you wanted to just reemphasize again?
I think I'm good. It was a very fun, entertaining conversation.
Yeah, we spent a lot of time on your career. And I really feel for people who are listening, I hope you've enjoyed it. There's one big fan of ours, John Lindsay, who listens to all of these podcasts, every single one. And
wow.
Yeah, he calls it windshield time. So he listens to them while he's in the car traveling. And he loves the in-depth conversation. So this important part of our conversation today is that we went in-depth on your career. Because I think at each pivot, at each point, you've done something that has really changed your life and has come round full circle, as you said, working in industry, working in-house, studying abroad in a US law firm, right? Getting into forensics and now where you are exploring this startup within a large company. So I wanted people to hear that story, and I hope John's enjoyed this one. I look forward to hearing his feedback later. So as you will know, we wind up with a couple of lighter questions, softer questions. We had one saying before that we talked about, right? Chiri smoreba yamato naru, small things grow into mountains. What other favorite saying do you have in English or in Japanese?
Perhaps always go for the best.
Always go for the best. Is there something like that in Japanese? Maybe that's US. Maybe that's not Japanese. There must be something. I wonder if there is.
There should be, but I can only come up with like a very blunt expression. Best を尽くせ.
Ah, best を尽くせ. Well, best を尽くせ.
尽くせ.
Best を尽くせ. Wow, love it. Okay, that's good. That can be your slogan. Can you share anything such as a book or a podcast that you've read or listened to recently that you'd recommend?
I recently read a book called Die with Zero.
Oh, wow.
It's talking from a financial perspective that you should not leave behind. But I thought that that also is true with how you spend your time. It's not only about money.
Ah, yes. I think I have seen that book referred to in a newsletter I get, which is by Sahil Bloom. And he recommended people go read that because that book says something. Says something about don't save all your money till the end when you can't actually use it. Use your money,
yes,
of course, in a good manner and consistently, and not just all at once. But use it through your life rather than dying with a pool of money but not having used it. So I think I saw that referred to recently and I've got it on my book list.
Ah.
Quite interesting that you brought that one up. What is something about you that a lot of people don't know?
Well, perhaps that I was called the queen of all-you-can-eat restaurants when I was in college.
Really?
Yes.
Oh, right. So that's quite popular in Japan, isn't it? The going to the all-you-can-eat buffet kind of place.
Right, right.
You are the queen.
Yeah, it was very, very popular and common during my undergrad days. And because you know you're so young and you're full of energy that you really want to get the best out of your money.
Course, value for money, and you can consume as much as you need, and you need it for the energy that you're talking about. That's beautiful. I'm so glad I asked you that question. Well, Naoko, we've come to the end of our chat today, and thank you so much for saying yes to come on the Lawyer on Air podcast. It's been really lovely to connect with you after so many years of not seeing
Yes.
you in person. I look forward to us catching up again soon.
Yes. Yeah. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. And for listeners who are interested to connect with you and learn a little bit more, is there somewhere they can connect with you?
Perhaps over LinkedIn.
Okay. We'll put the link to your LinkedIn profile in the show notes. And I hope that anyone who's listened to this and found something very interesting about it can maybe give us a review or tell us what you liked about it. We love hearing from everybody who's listened and enjoyed an episode to tell us what they think. And so, for everyone today, that's it for now. See you on the next episode. Cheers, kanpai, and bye for now. Thank you so much for listening today to this episode of Lawyer on Air. I really hope that you were inspired by the story you heard and that you discovered something new about women in the law. Please subscribe to the show so that you don't miss future episodes. And if you can think of even just one person to share this episode with, that would make my day. I invite you to connect with me to talk more. Jump on over to LinkedIn or Instagram where you can find me, or send me a message via my website contact page. That's all from me today. I look forward to seeing you right here on the next episode of Lawyer on Air. Cheers, kanpai, and bye for now.